And that is our open.
I dare you. I dare you.
No, no.
There's the open. That's awesome. Elliot, put your head back. Close your eyes. Imagine this. Hockey Island. Just an island somewhere. We don't know where it is. And there's a hockey rink. And there's camera positions. The announcers are somewhere else. There are no fans. There's just hockey players and a hockey rink. Players are flown in. They might not even know where the island is. We broadcast games on Hockey Island, coming to you from parts unknown. On Hockey Island, it's Hockey Night in Canada. It's Scotiabank Wednesday Night Hockey. It's Hockey Island. Elliot, is this the way out?
Who are you, Dana White?
You saw that, right?
Yes, he's coming up with UFC he's Island.
Coming up with more the updated reality version of Mortal Kombat.
Who would be the NHL's Sub-Zero?
Ooh, great question. That's a great question for Twitter.
That's a good point, Jeff. We can let the tweeters answer who the NHL version of Sub-Zero is. The WrestleMania ratings were apparently really good. I haven't seen them. I was told that. Mm-hmm.
No surprise.
I watched it. I go up and down on wrestling, but I watched it, A, because there's not much else to watch, and B, because I wanted to see what they would do. You know, how can you make something that has your atmosphere taken away entertaining and exciting? And I think those guys deserve a lot of credit. I thought they did the best that they absolutely could. But like, I look at the UFC thing, and I look at the WWE ratings as I've been told they are. When you were hearing that MLB, it wants to start up in May in Phoenix, which I think is a crazy plan. I don't think they're going to be able to do that at all. But I understand why everybody's saying we have to be ready when we're allowed to do it, because people are going to be starving for something to watch. Mm-hmm. And the moment you're told you're allowed to do it, you're going to have to flick your switch like that.
You have the captive audience, and UFC is going forward with UFC 249, Tony Ferguson and Justin Gaethje. The card looks really good. Like, I'll just be blunt. Like, it looks like a really good card on April the 18th. They are going forward with it. We saw Dana White, to your point, musing about Fighter Island, Mortal Kombat Island, whatever you want to call it, and flying fighters in and putting on fights every week, because you know that you will have a captive audience right now, that you have sports fans right now that are thirsty for anything right now. Just give us something new. Baseball fans, football fans, basketball fans, hockey fans, NASCAR, whatever. Give us something and we will go. You will have everybody's attention. So I'm not surprised if WrestleMania's numbers are good. I won't be surprised if UFC 249 with Ferguson and Gaethje does a tremendous number for UFC. People are starved for something, which is why, unless this should not be a surprise to anybody, if you're, just for the purposes of this podcast, Gary Bettman, commissioner of the NHL, of course you're modeling for different scenarios. What happens if we can come back on the 1st of June? What happens if it's the 1st of July, the 1st of August, the 1st of September? I would imagine there's a number of different models, because to your point, when the health authorities say that it's safe to go back to work, to go back to play, to resume your league. You know, when the mayor at Amityville says it's okay to go back into the water, they want to be ready and they want to be able to maximize right away, because people are coming at this thing thirsty.
I think that's all true. I think that's all true. Now, one thing I just wanted to mention. So the other night we talked about how North Dakota is on the list of places they could potentially play this. And one of the issues there is going to be hotels. There simply is not the infrastructure hotel-wise to do it. So that is the biggest strike against it. But their arena is spectacular. If you've ever been there or you know it, it's beautiful and it definitely fits.
Marble floors, Elliot. It's gorgeous.
It makes total sense. It could house several teams. But it wouldn't all be in North Dakota. maybe it was my fault for not writing it clear enough. I did put in more than one site would need to be done, but people seem to read it as it's all going to be there. It wouldn't all be there. There would be multiple sites. I don't know if 4 or 6 or 8 or whatever, but there would be multiple sites. That way that it would determine the runoff to the Stanley Cup final if we could have it.
But this is completely out of everybody's hands.
We're not going to, like Jeff, like I've said this, we're not going to know until May or June what we're capable of doing.
I don't know. I remain skeptical to the point about I would be concerned about next season.
Jeff, this is an optimistic podcast.
I'm getting too down. I'm getting too cynical now.
I don't want downer Jeff here. This is an optimistic podcast. Now, look, people out there, our listeners out there, we know it's tough. And I don't want to make light of that in any way, shape, or form. But I just believe, because the way I live my life is, you have to believe that at some point the best is going to happen. That's the way I have to live. And I realize it's not in the short term. Like, I think Major League Baseball saying May is not realistic, but I think we have to understand that we don't know anything until the end of May, beginning of June, and then we'll see. And Jeff, you might turn out to be right. Dr. Negative may turn out to be right. But until I know,
okay,
I'm hoping for the best.
Okay. You know what? You know what's positive? Through all of this, because we've all had a lot of time now on our hands to go investigate vintage games, to watch rewind events, go down YouTube wormholes that you can't when the hockey season is on, because there are always games on every single night, and we watch them, and you watch them as well, gentle listener. You know what I watched yesterday?
What's that?
OHL Rewind. So the Ontario Hockey League is doing these rewind shows. It's so good. I love the way it's packaged up too. They're doing OHL Rewind. So I watched from 1984, Elliot, and I'm going some with this, and you're going to like it. So 1984, Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds, coached by Terry Crisp, facing off against the Oshawa Generals. Paul Theriault, the bench boss there. Sherry Basson is the general manager. The host of the entire affair, since it's broadcast on Global, is Mike Anscombe, and you know how much I love Mike Anscombe. And the play-by-play color commentary booth is, you want to venture a guess?
Somebody we know, right?
Gary Green is the analyst.
Wow.
Play-by-play is a very young but so polished already.
Paul Romanuk.
Jim Houston.
And now for more on the two teams, let's go upstairs to our broadcast colleagues, Jim Houston and Gary Green.
Hello again, everyone. Gary, put yourself in Terry Crisp's position today. You played on Thursday night. You rode the bus down to Kingston and played on Friday night. Third game in 3 days against a team like Oshawa. How are you going to play it today?
Jim Houston.
Well, no, Elliot, it's so good.
Well, we could have had him on this podcast if you
were going to
bring this up.
Listen.
Well, he's going to have to come on next week.
We're going to have Huey come on and talk to us about Sue and Oshawa from 84. Even though Rick Tocchet wasn't in the game for the Greyhounds, was still a pretty good game. Craig Simpson will be joining us here in a little while, who you watch and listen to alongside Jim Houston, our lead crew from Hockey Night in Canada. Gary Lawless will be aboard as well. We'll talk to the mayor of Hockey Vegas, I think is what I've settled on for his title as well. So we will talk to him. And Ken Holland, the general manager of the Edmonton Oilers, will drop by for a pretty interesting conversation. I think you're really going to like this one. But that's the one find that I've stumbled across so far online. OHL Rewind, Greyhounds, Generals, Mike Anscombe, Jim Houston, and Gary Green. What a godsend for each. How about you?
Well, first of all, I think that would be incredible to watch. I remember Jack Miller calling a lot of those games.
Oh, sure. There's a lot of those games out there with the legendary Belleville play-by-play voice. Absolutely.
Okay, so I have to say that I don't remember those games, but I will take a look. That's a good one. You know, Jeff, I got to tell you, I'm getting tired of television.
In what sense?
I've just been watching so much of it. I've watched Homeland to catch up with it. I've watched a couple of our classic games. Mm-hmm. To watch them. I watched a couple of the watch parties to watch them and support our group. You know, I want to be supportive of the stuff that our Sportsnet employees are doing. But I have to tell you, I'm getting tired of looking at screens. I really am. And I get tired of it a lot in general, but now particularly, I'm having trouble. I'm just like in front of the TV again. I'm really actually struggling with that. So I'm trying to do some more reading. Mm-hmm. The weather's getting better in Toronto. I took an hour-long bike ride yesterday. I am trying to find some other things to do because I admit I'm struggling with the amount of TV that I'm watching, and I really feel that I've hit my saturation point.
You're still working out though, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Working out, riding your bike, you're reading. What am I missing here? That's good.
Yeah, no. I know it is good, but I've also been doing like a lot of work. I'm working on a couple of projects of the podcast. So,
right.
But I'm just saying that like I'm getting tired of the television. I don't know if anybody else is getting this right now, but I'm getting tired of the TV.
I don't watch until the evening right now because we have a nightly routine now with the kids. After a three-year-old goes down, I'll make a little bit of supper for me and my wife, and we will sit down with our two boys, 10 and 8, and you let me know whether this is good parenting or not.
Okay.
So I've never seen The Walking Dead series, ever. And our kids are fascinated by zombies. So last week we started episode 1, season 1 of The Walking Dead, and we'll watch usually 2, sometimes 3 episodes before the kids go to bed. I thought there would be nightmares. I thought there would be I can't sleep, Dad, but there hasn't been. Quite the opposite has happened. Will my wife and I be on the cover of next month's edition of Today's Parent Magazine, Elliot?
You see, I have to tell you that I think in this day and age, there's no such thing as bad parenting.
There's no such thing as bad parenting? Oh, there is bad parenting.
I think now, like all the kids are home, everybody, you know what? If Walking Dead gets you through, yeah. I got no problem with that.
What if I may or may not have told the kids at the beginning of episode 1 that we're showing you this because we want you to know where all of this is heading? Would that make me a bad parent, Elliot?
Yeah, that might scare them a little bit. Like I'll tell you, I played cornhole with Max today.
What is that?
Cornhole is when you throw the beanbags into the holes on the ground.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Okay.
So he was getting mad because I kept on making him shoot from farther because I wanted him to improve his aim. Like he can hit it from close,
yeah. But
you know, you want to make it more of a challenge. And he was missing for a while, which is okay. Like I don't get up on him. I want him to learn. He'll practice. He'll get better. I'm good with that. But boy, he was starting to get really frustrated and really mad. And he wanted to go in and I wouldn't let him in for a while. And that was when I was beginning to wonder if this was bad parenting. And I wasn't even getting mad at him. Like, you know, hey, as long as you try and give it a good effort, you'll figure it out eventually. I think forcing your son to play cornhole when he's on a losing streak is worse than having them watch The Walking Dead.
I have AAA hockey kids. You want to see bad parenting? Come to the rink sometime.
Yeah.
Trust me. On that, we'll kick it off. 31 Thoughts, the podcast presented by GMC Sierra Trucks. Okay, welcome into the podcast, two of your favorite parents, Elliot Friedman and yours truly, Jeff Merrick. Before we get to Ken Holland, Elliot, and this is a really nice conversation with Ken, with some pretty interesting stuff about his time with the Detroit Red Wings and his thoughts on how a Russian Hockey Hall of Famer could have become a member of the Detroit Red Wings. More on that in moments. I want to get your thoughts on Rick Peckham. Now, there are a number of great broadcast crews around the NHL. And I've always put Rick Peckham right up there, right around the top, consistently, year in and year out. Here's a guy that, you know, stretches back to, he used to do play-by-play for the Rochester Americans, but then in the NHL to the Hartford Whalers, and now, of course, with the Tampa Bay Lightning. As much as we might look at the NHL now and look at players, if the season is wiped out, and I know you don't want me to be negative here, Elliot, but if it is, you know, we'll look at players like Justin Williams and Craig Anderson and Jimmy Howard and Ryan Miller and maybe Derek Engeland and Trevor Daley, these types of players, Roman Polak, maybe Jason Spezza, and say, you know, they may have played their last NHL game without knowing that it was their last NHL game. I wonder if Rick Peckham, who was planning on retiring at the end of this season, may have already called his last NHL game, and it was a 2-1 loss at the hands of the Toronto Maple Leafs right before the pause. I wonder if that might be it for what was an outstanding career for one of the finest play-by-play men in the business, period.
Well, I hope not. You know, he came to Toronto pretty late in the year, and we were just chatting about, you know, what he was thinking about for the future, and I don't know if he had a ton of plans at that point in time, but you would hope that he gets a final game or two. You know, the Lightning would be a playoff team at least to say goodbye officially on the air. It'll be interesting. I mean, we're going to have to get him on. We're going to have to talk to him about that.
Yeah.
But I really hope that whatever happens, I hope that he goes out in a way that he's satisfied with. I could see some people, Jeff, saying, you know what? I already said it was going to be my last year. I'm good with this. And I could see other people saying, I want that last game. So I hope whatever he wants, he can do it.
That's what I was hoping to get to here, is if this season is squashed and that's it, I hope that Tampa, if Rick wants it, parks one game next season, call it Rick Peckham Appreciation Night, call it whatever you want, and he gets to do his final game. That way, the rug isn't just pulled out from underneath him.
Yeah, I could see that happen.
He's one of the best. He's a treasure. Like, he's a treasure in the NHL. I love, like, every interaction I've ever had with Rick Peckham has been delightful. Every Tampa game that I've heard has been so well called. Yeah. And I just hope this guy gets to have his last game on his terms. And I think we're on the same page about that, obviously.
I agree. And the other thing, too, is it was never about him, right?
Yeah.
When he worked with Bobby Taylor,
oh,
the league used to go crazy at Bobby Taylor because he would rip the referees. And they would just go bananas about it. And Peckham would just do what he did. He just did his job. And so it was never about him. And I remember the first Stanley Cup final I did was Tampa Bay, Calgary in 03-04. And you could tell, like, just the respect that Tortorella had for him. Mm. Like, when Peckham in the pregame meetings, because he would do the games on radio, when Peckham in the pregame meetings would ask a question, Tortorella would make sure that he got a good answer to his question. And he would always say, did you get what you need? I think that says a lot about the high regard he is held in.
That's awesome. All right. So earlier on today, and again, this is late in the Tuesday afternoon, we're recording this podcast. Earlier today, we had a chance to sit down with Ken Holland for about 45 minutes, Elliot. He's in Vernon, British Columbia right now, as we're all on pause. He's no different, getting things done, still, you know, working as a general manager of the Edmonton Oilers, checking in, modeling, planning things. I remember talking to Brian Burke on Hockey Central a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about teams you felt really bad for that this season paused, teams that had exceeded expectations. And Burke said, I feel bad for two teams specifically. One, Vancouver, because they were very much in the hunt and no one really gave them any shot. And he said, I also feel really bad for the Edmonton Oilers. And as someone who's worked for the Vancouver Canucks and the Calgary Flames, it's tough to cheer for the Oilers, but there's Berkey. And he said, this is a team that very few pick to do what they have done so far this season. And for that, you feel really bad for Ken Holland in his first year as GM of the Edmonton Oilers. Before we get to Ken, a quick thought on Edmonton.
Well, what a great year for them. They obviously exceeded expectations. And when they started going poorly in November and December, everybody thought, I knew it. They're garbage.
Yeah.
And here they are, and they're okay. Now, we should also let people know that we recorded this podcast before we knew about the Colby Cave news. And after we recorded everything, the Oilers released the news that Colby Cave had suffered a brain bleed and is in hospital at Sunnybrook in Toronto. And obviously, we send the best to Colby Cave, his family, and his friends. But we wanted to let you know that the reason that Ken Holland is not asked about Colby Cave in this is because the news came out after the podcast was taped.
All of our thoughts with Colby Cave, his family, and his friends at this most horrible time for that young man. Here's Ken Holland, general manager of the Edmonton Oilers. Elliot, it's always good when an architect can stop by the podcast. And today we have the architect of the Edmonton Oilers, Oilers general manager Ken Holland joins us. Ken, first of all, thanks so much for taking time today. What is Ken Holland's new normal? What is Ken Holland's day-to-day like?
Good morning, guys. It's certainly a strange world, but I was in Edmonton for about a week or 10 days after the pause, the shut, we ended the season. And I've come out to Vernon, BC now, which was about a 9-hour drive to be out here. I work the phones a little bit in the morning. We do some once a week. We do pro-scouting meetings. I talk to Bob Nicholson every day, a few times a day. Talk to Tyler Wright, my chief scout, a little bit, but for the most part, it's pretty quiet.
I had a chance to talk to Cole Perfetti, and he said that some teams are still doing draft calls with him. How much business are you actually doing right now just to keep yourself from going crazy?
Doing some business. You know, we had a conference call this week with Jay Woodcroft, our coach of Bakersfield, Keith Gretzky, who the general manager of Bakersfield, and myself, and just to go over what we want the 2021 team to look like. You know, on a regular basis, I'm sort of looking at our roster from this year and looking forward to next year. Obviously, have no idea what the cap is going to be. It's tough to kind of plan because certainly there's so much unknown out there. You know, when are we going to pick up and how much of the season are we going to play? When is the off season going to be? What's the salary cap going to look like for next year? That's all got to be figured out, obviously, between the league and the union, and the pandemic is going to weigh into that. And hopefully we're able to finish the season and play a full playoffs. I think that's what everybody's hoping, and get our business back up and running and get people back. But certainly that's a long ways out there. There's so much has to happen. The health officials have to do their thing, and the scientists to try to make this a safer world for us all.
Give us a little peek then behind the curtain. I'm curious about how you model your franchise right now, given the uncertainty about something. You just mentioned the salary cap, 88, 84, 81, whatever. Do you have in your mind, or does your group put together scenarios where this is what our team's going to look like if it's 88 million. This is what it's going to look like if it's 84. This is what it's going to look like if it's 81, dare I say 79. Would that be something that would be on the day-to-day activities of Ken Holland and his group?
Well, first off, Jeff, you know, obviously I put the commitments on, you know, we've got my, you know, my worksheet there that I work on in every now and then basis, whether we're running up, if this was normal and when the season was over and whether you missed the playoffs or you made the playoffs, you know, from the end of the regular season up until July 1st, you know, I think from a manager's perspective, if your team is in the playoffs, obviously you're involved with your team, but then you're still planning. So, you know, now not knowing what the cap is going to be obviously makes it more difficult to plan. I think that it's, whenever we've had a work stoppage in the past, the union and the league have done a great job in finding a solution to try to make it as level a playing field as possible, at the same time making sure that it's as good as possible for the players. And I'm sure that same will happen here over the course of the next few months. So I know what I'd like to do. You know, I know the players within the system that I think are going to come to camp next year and compete for a spot, give them a chance to grab a spot on the Edmonton Oilers in 2021. Certainly either trades or free agency, there's a couple things you're always trying to do to make your team a little bit different or a little bit better.
All right, so Ken, give us a list of the free agents you're thinking of pursuing and the players you might be interested in trading for. Okay, since I know you're not going to do that, give me a couple guys, because, you know, Jay Woodcroft has done a really good job for you in Bakersfield. Who are the guys you think next year on that team who could compete to become Edmonton Oilers?
You know, Bouchard was a first-round pick, 10th overall, 2-3 years ago. Had a real good year in the American Hockey League this year. Certainly, he's going to come into camp, and we're going to give him a chance to earn the spot on the team. Sam Marukov had a bit of a struggle the first half of the year in the American League. Part of it was ice time. We had some veterans down there, and Caleb Jones was down there, and some people, as we had injuries and we went through the year, he played much better opportunity. He played much better the second half of the year. Benson up front played, five, six, seven games. He had 66 points, a rookie a year ago. This year, not quite as good a year, but he's smart. He's got hockey sense. He's competitive. So those would be probably the three players that would be given a real good look. Broberg, who he signed, I think, depending on when training camp is, I talked to his agent, his European agent recently, and his North American agent, Darren Ferris. We've agreed that if he's not going to be in the Edmonton Oilers in 2021, he's going to play in Skellefteå. So if training camp is normal, I'd like to bring him over and give him a chance to make the team, but certainly that's an unknown. So those would be the players in our system that are the closest.
Jeff, if I could just ask one question here. I wanted to think of a real one that would say, you would just look at me and say, Elliot, are you freaking kidding me? So this is the question I came up with. If you had a Hart Trophy vote, Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl?
I wouldn't fill out the ballot. You know what, Elliot? I feel very, very fortunate. You know, I was so fortunate in Detroit through the years to be strong down the middle. You know, in the late 90s and early 2000s or 90s, we had Fedorov and Yzerman. And then as their careers, you know, they started to, Sergei left and obviously Steve retired. We had Zetterberg and Datsyuk, and Pav and Z could play together. Z could play left wing. Pav could center one line. Zetterberg could center another line. And I feel so fortunate to have these two players that they can play together in the power play. They've got wonderful chemistry. Obviously, we saw what they accomplished last year playing together and early this year. And then at Christmas time when called up Yamamoto, Coach Tippett broke them up and had Leon centering one line and Connor centering another line. So, you know, you got two superstars and you can do so many things with them that I feel so fortunate to be manager of a team that has two players. They're 23 and 24 years old, just turned 23 and 24 late last year and early this year. So the best years are still ahead of them and both great, great players. I wouldn't want to have a vote, but I feel very, very fortunate to be able to manage a team that both are on the team.
Ken, I want to ask about your blue line. And you talked about players like, you know, Evan Bouchard and Philip Roberg a couple of seconds ago, and those are players that are on the horizon. Two players on your blue line this season that I think really moved that blue line along, and maybe you consider it found money. Maybe they're right on track. I'm not sure where you had them in your mind. But in your words, what did Ethan Bear and Caleb Jones do to this back end this season?
Well, Jeff, great question. When I took over here on May the 6th and met with the people here, they talked about Ethan Bear, Caleb Jones, William Lagesson, and the way Bouchard had played. So I think we had seven players, defensemen on one-way contracts. I wanted to create an opportunity. So, and also we needed some cap space. So we bought out Sequeira, and he went from a 5.5 cap number to 2.5 on a buyout. So we opened up $3 million of cap space, which we went out and signed some, I think, three forwards at around $1 million. And then we went to training camp. And early on, Ethan Bear sort of grabbed that spot and found some chemistry, found real good chemistry with Darnell Nurse. And he's been top 4 minutes all year long, and some nights he's been in our top two in terms of minutes played. So, and then when Klefbom got injured in February or whatever, we were losing the guy that was playing the most minutes on our team. You're never really sure. Caleb Jones stepped in there and played in our top four and played great. So I think you've nailed it. You know, great job by the Oilers scouts from the past. If you think about, I think, I'm not sure what year, but rounds 4, 5, and 6, they took Bear, Jones, and Marino. Unfortunately, we couldn't sign Marino. We traded him to Pittsburgh. But, you know, you got three NHL defensemen in rounds 4, 5, and 6. So great job by the Oilers scouts in a past draft. And in order to be competitive in a salary cap world, you've got to have a push of young kids for a variety of reasons. But obviously, you need some players on the team that can really contribute. Either they're on entry-level contracts or they're on low second contracts. And that's what Ethan Bear did for us, and also Caleb Jones. So both are young, mobile, puck-moving defensemen. Both are competitive. Caleb Jones is really, he can play left defense or right defense. We played him quite a bit on right defense at times. When you got a guy that can play left left and right. You know, you carry seven defensemen, but if you got a defenseman in your roster that's comfortable playing right or left, it's like carrying eight defensemen, just because if you lose a righty, he can slide over and right. If you lose a lefty, he can slide over on the left. So certainly Caleb gives us some versatility and some depth, not only for this year, but heading into next year. But very good surprises for the Edmonton Oilers, pleasant surprises for me, certainly.
I'm just curious about your relationship with McDavid. You know, you start and we find out he's got this significant injury, which he battles very impressively from to get back. But one thing I've heard is that you've really worked hard on creating a relationship with him through his agent, Jeff Jackson, because, you know, you recognize his importance and you recognize the two of you are going to have to do this together. How do you go about that? How does your relationship work?
First off, Coach Tippett talks to Connor every day, you know, and I know he talks to Leon. One of the things that I've been, you know, in the world that we live in today, the communication between the coach and the player and your top player is so important. And that's one of Dave Tippett's strengths as a coach. My managing philosophy really is to, I want the players to understand the coach is their direct. He's their boss. He doles out the ice time. He makes the line combinations. I'm in charge of the 23-man roster as to who's on the team. I work with the coach and talk about it. But I think it's important that the players understand that the coach has got the authority to play people lots or not play people as much. So my relationship with Connor is I'm not talking to him on an everyday basis. I talk to him over the course of the year. Steve Yzerman, Nick Lidstrom, Zetterberg were the three captains that I had in Detroit. Three or four times a year, I'd have a, you know, I call it a business meeting where I call him in and we talk about leading up to July for leading up to the draft and get the captain's opinion about, or at the end of the season, when our season was over shortly thereafter, spend two or three hours one day and getting the captain's perspective as to what he thinks our team needs heading into the offseason. As you, during the season, if you're floundering at some point in time, maybe get a feeling, certainly two or three weeks before the trade deadline to meet with the captain to get his opinion. I have talked a lot to Jeff Jackson, not as much to Connor, but enough to Connor. I know what he's thinking. I know what his thoughts are about the team and talk a little bit, but at the end of the day, the person that has done a great job in building up a really everyday relationship with Connor is Dave Tippett.
You know, Bob Gainey once in an interview talked about handling different players, and he said, you're going to be a pretty dismal team if you don't have any difficult players to handle, because good players are not easy to handle. In your experience now with Edmonton and, of course, previous with Detroit, is that an accurate statement?
First off, anything Bob Gainey says, I agree with. I've been a manager's room with him, and he is, you know, his vision. And I mean, he was talking about things in the game 15 years ago that we're doing today at the manager's level. So dealing with top players, you know, first off, it's the coach. You get back, it's the coach is there every day, and the coach has got to, you know, there's that fine line between pushing and pulling back and trying to figure out a way to get the most out of each individual player and then the team. You know, I think most, if not all, of the best players that I've dealt with, either in Edmonton now and in Detroit, they want to win. They're motivated to win. They push. And what makes them great, number one, obviously, is their skill set. They've got a great skill set. But what separates them to go to the upper tier is the mental toughness, the determination, the desire to be better than everybody else. And so you got to harness that. The coach and the manager have to make sure that it's harnessed. And I kind of think back to the relationship between Steve Yzerman and Scotty Bowman and how Steve wanted to win and Scotty wanted the team to play a certain way. And when Steve was all in, everybody else was all in. So I just think that the great young players, you know, coming through Pee Wee and through Bantam and through Midget and through whether it's college or Europe or major junior hockey, they've been superstars and they continue to be superstars. Now they're going to come in, they might play a little bit less ice time, or you want them to make adjustments to their game. And that's where you got to communicate and work with that player. But the great players, they're great for a reason. And certainly you got to be very respectful of their skill set, of their determination, of what they want to accomplish, because the bottom line is they want the same thing that we do. They want they want to win. We got to just make sure that everybody is on the same page, because ultimately it is a team, and we have to win as a team. Everybody's got a different role, bigger roles, lesser roles. It needs to be a team.
Ken, when you first met with the Oilers as a group at the beginning of training camp this year, some people have told me you gave a really good talk about how Detroit was once a down team and how they built themselves into a champion. And a number of people who were in that room, and they told me I could never say who they were, said it was a really inspiring, excellent speech that explained to everybody how it was going to happen and how important everybody was. Can you give us an idea of what you told them?
When I knew that was near the end in Detroit for me, you know, Steve Yzerman had stepped down, and I had talked to Chris Ilitch, and I just know it's time. I just knew it was time. I had an unbelievable run, and I wasn't sure where I was going with my career. The owners in Detroit, Mrs. Ilitch and Chris Ilitch, made me an incredible offer to stay there as a senior vice president. I talked to Steve. Steve wanted me to stay, and I had to decide if that's, you know, that was certainly a possibility, because I'd been with the Red Wings for 36 years. And then when this opportunity came and I met with Bob Nicholson and talked about going to Edmonton, you know, everybody's in the game. And I think, my speech, we're all in the game. We want to win the Stanley Cup or compete for the Stanley Cup. And you want to believe you got a chance if you play your very best, that it's good enough to be better than everybody else. And, you know, the last 3 years in Detroit, we had missed the playoffs. And we had 25 years in a row making the playoffs. And when you make the playoffs, you got a chance. And then, and I just talked about the building of the Red Wings, late 80s, early 90s, how we built into a team and, you know, the confidence. And I just, you know, for me personally, I haven't been, you know, talked about how exciting, and, you know, they know from 2 years ago when I think they beat San Jose in the first round and lost to Anaheim, you know, how exciting the playoffs are. And you want it. It's fun to be in that tournament every year, how every city, you know, you watch the Stanley Cup playoffs and the Final Four and the finals, and you see people outside the building and there's people on the streets, and they're, and it's overflowing and the energy of the city. And I remember when Edmonton knocked us out in 05-06, we had 126 points, and he knocked out in game six. And I can remember game six, I think we were up 1-0 after two periods, and then they scored to make it 1-1, and there was just an onslaught of emotion from the fans pouring out, and the Oilers cranked it up, and they knocked us out of the Stanley Cup playoffs. So just talked about trying to build, that we all wanted to build, hired a coach that wants to win a Stanley Cup. He's been around, coached 1,200, 1,400 games in the National Hockey League, and we've both come to Edmonton, and our vision is to build the team into a team that can legitimately compete for a Stanley Cup. And for me, what does that mean? It means you're making the playoffs. You want to make the playoffs every year. And if you don't make it, you want to make the playoffs 4 out of 5 years. Or you need multiple opportunities. And then somehow, some way you build your team into where you open at home, you know, in the first round. What does that mean? Well, it means that you're in the top four of points out of 15 or 16 teams over 82 games. It means something. I mean, to open at home and get home ice, it means that you've played at a high level for a long period of time to be in the top four teams in your conference. And we built that in Detroit, and we were able to compete on a year-to-year basis. And certainly, looking at the age of lots of the players in Edmonton, what they'd accomplished leading up to that point in time, that Tip and I both thought that we feel very fortunate that we've got a core of really good players, and we needed to try to build it and grow it. I want to be in the playoffs just as bad as they want to be in the playoffs. You miss being in the playoffs because it's so much fun. So I can't remember what I said, but at the end of the day, Elliot, everybody's in this game to try to compete for the Stanley Cup and play your way in and feel, and then get excited to 4 days later, you're in a best of seven series. You're going to head to head with the team every second day for 2 weeks. And the best team is going to advance on to the next round. That's why we play the game. And I haven't had those juices flowing. And personally, in the last 3 years, I think with the 3 years in a row, we woke up at Christmas time in Detroit 10 points or more out of a playoff spot. And, you know, we can talk about playing your way in, but you start to be 10 points behind the eighth seed and you got 40 games to go and multiple teams to climb over. It's a reach. So talked about playing our way into the 1st of March and being in a position to control our own fate and the opportunity to try to build a group and create a team that can compete, legitimately compete for a Stanley Cup. Hmm.
Ken, once upon a time, Sam Pollock offered Bill Torrey five Montreal Canadiens players in exchange for the first overall draft pick that turned into a Denny Potvin. Bill Torrey is, as we all know, no longer around to tell that story. And I always love talking to general managers, but I do wonder why we see hockey books from players, we see hockey books from coaches, certainly from journalists, from writers, etc., but so seldom, if ever, and there's been a couple, one really good one, Behind the Moves by Jason Ferris, do we ever see general managers write books about their time in the NHL? Why do you think that is? I mean, I opened this interview up by saying, you know, we're talking to an architect. You know, the general managers are the people that put it all together. They make the Rubik's Cube fits. How come so few of them, if at all, document any of it for hockey history?
Jeff, good question. I know Jeff Devolano wrote a book, and I read the book. I actually, you know what? It's funny you talk about that question, Jeff, because last night I sat in my office here in Vernon, and the moving truck from Detroit dropped off all our belongings at my Vernon house here, I think February the 10th or something. So they've been sitting in a box, and boxes and boxes and boxes in my garage here, and we're slowly going through there. I sat in my office last night and I kept a whole bunch of paper clippings from, I think it started out in about early 90s, and I was just going through them through 96, 97, 98 when we won the cups, and I was reading these clippings. So it certainly it was a walk down memory lane for me last night for a couple of hours as I was putting stuff in boxes. I'm trying to figure out where to stuff it here in the office and stuff, and certainly did, like I said, it was a walk down memory lane about lots of my experiences in Detroit. So I'm not sure why more managers don't document. I'm not sure how many people. I know if I wrote one, I know I'd probably have five copies. So Cindy, my wife, and our four kids would buy one. So just I had a few friends. I'd probably sell 20 or 30, and I'm not even sure sell. They probably all expect to have a book for free. So I'm probably the cost and the time, but certainly sure if more managers, if some managers would write a book, it would be a good read.
Ken, I got two more for you. First, out of all those clippings that you go through, what brings back the best memories of those ones you read?
You know what? It's the low times make the high times feel like it's never smooth sailing. It's never, we want it to be smooth sailing. You know, I watched the movie The Russian Five three or four times. You know, for me, I got to live it about Fedorov and Yzerman, Konstantinov, Kozlov and Fetisov and their role with the Red Wings and how losing in to 96 in the third round. You know, all the disappointments. And ultimately, when we won the Cup in 97, Jim Devolano took over the Red Wings in, as in, I think, 1983 when the Ilitches bought it. And 15 years later, you know, you're standing on the top of the peak, but it's 15 years and so much had to go right. And then it was a different time because, you know, the communist Russia, and we got Fedorov in the fourth round. Well, today Fedorov would go in the top two or three picks on the in the draft. So what it is it's a roller coaster ride, and you're never quite as bad as you think or you feel you might be, and you're never quite as good or secure as you think you might be. It's the National Hockey League is so competitive, it's so close. It's the 31 best general managers in the world. It's going to be 32's team, and the best 32 coaches and coaching staff and scouting staffs. And it's competitive, and the rules with the salary cap are designed for parity. So it's going to be a roller coaster ride. You know, some years we didn't have a roller coaster ride in 05, 06, coming out of a work stoppage, and we go out and get 126 points, and we lose in the first round of the Edmonton Oilers. So the difference between so many teams is so close. So going through all those clippings last night reminded me, I'm reading the clippings about the 97 and 98, but also about the 93 and 94, losing in the first round in 94 to San Jose, getting upset by San Jose. I think we were 35 points ahead. So you're going to have ups and you're going to have downs. And when you have downs, you just got to be steady on the rudder. At times, you got to make adjustments, you got to make moves, but you got to be steady on the rudder. And then And when things are going good, try to ride that wave as long as you can, because you know it's gonna turn.
My last one for you, Ken, is which current other general manager in the National Hockey League would make the best vacuum salesman? No, we'll explain the story around.
Okay, we'll explain the story. All right.
Sure, there's a few in there, but it's a great product. I think part of being a general manager, you got to sell a little bit when it comes time to try to get a deal done or negotiate a contract. So we've all got a little bit of salesman in us. When if you become a manager in the league, you got to have a little bit of salesman in you.
I love that answer. And Ken, thank you so much for your time. Before we let you go, one question, because you mentioned Sergei Fedorov a couple of moments ago. He's come up a couple of different times in this interview. And I asked you about writing a book before. One thing that I would love to know, if Ken Holland ever wrote a book, I was told that in 1989, after Detroit took Sergei Fedorov in the fourth round, I think it was either in the fifth where you guys took Makosh, I believe, or in the fifth where you took Dallas Drake, there was some discussion at the table about taking Pavel Bure. How close were Detroit to getting both Fedorov and Bure at that draft?
We were going to take Bure on our fifth pick. Anil Smith, the chief scout, walked up to the desk, the central scouting desk, and asked if it was a different time. We know all that now. And they had told, he was come back to the table and said, if we take Pavel Bure, it's going to be an ineligible pick. We took somebody else. And then Christer Rockstrom, who was a European scout, spent the next 35 minutes convincing Jim Devolano and Neil Smith to take Bure because he had to have played, I think, 7 or 9 games in the Russian men's league to be eligible for any rounds. And if he played less, he was only in the first three rounds. We were going to take him on pick 6, and 2 picks before we picked, Vancouver took him and proved what Christer Rockstrom was convincing us that we could. So it would have been something else to have Fedorov and Bure. But we did take Konstantinov in the 11th round. Certainly that 89 draft for the Red Wings, getting Konstantinov, Lidstrom, Fedorov, all in the same draft. He added him to Steve Yzerman, really changed the fortunes and the history of hockey in Detroit for 20 years. So it would have been nice to have the two of them together, but feel fortunate with all the players we did get.
Are you going to put that story in your book, Ken?
Yeah, that would be a good story. I started scouting in 85, 86. So I went to the World Junior Championships in Alaska that year, and they had a line of Bure, Fedorov, and McGillney, and they were dancing, and they won the gold medal. It's the first time I'd ever seen all those players play, and great job by Neil Smith and Christer Rockstrom. Those are the two people responsible for Nick Lidstrom being drafted in the third round by the Detroit Red Wings. So Neil Smith did a fabulous job as the chief scout of the Detroit Red Wings, and then obviously went on to a wonderful career with the New York Rangers. So that story definitely is going to go in the book. It was a great day for the Red Wing franchise. I had a bit part. Neil Smith and Jim Devolano and Christer Rockstrom had the lead parts.
Great stories. Listen, you've parked a lot of time for us today. Thank you so much, Ken. This has been a delight.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
All right, Elliot, everybody wants to know, because it is a great one, what's the vacuum cleaner story?
So Ken Holland's last year as a pro was 84-85. He played 4 NHL games. He was drafted by the Maple Leafs in 1975. Who did he play for in the American Hockey League?
Adirondack.
First.
Broome County Dusters.
The Broome County Dusters and the Broome Dusters. And then he went to Hartford's organization where he played 1 game. And then he went to Detroit's where he played his last 3. And his last season was 84-85. He was a member of the Adirondack Red Wings. And it wasn't going anywhere for him. And he was deciding the next phase of his life. And at that time, also, he's coming up on being 30 years old. So his mother wanted him to be a vacuum cleaner salesman. She sent him an ad. And she also promised him to be her first sale. He was thinking about it. And basically what happened was the Red Wings made him the offer to become a Western Canada scout.
Yes.
And that's where his career as an executive began. But that's how close he was to becoming a vacuum salesman. And that's why I asked the question.
I think he was also pitched that a number of people from his family would buy vacuums. Like five or six people were already lined up to buy vacuums. So he had a base to start working from. That this, like, they really wanted Ken to sell vacuums and get out of this crazy hockey lifestyle. Great story. You know who's on that Broome County Dusters team, by the way? And that was a slugging league.
Yeah.
Paul Stewart was on that team. I remember talking to, there's someone we should get on the podcast. As the NHL is on pause right now for great stories, because he was the first one to tell me about Ken as a goaltender in the minors. Stu would be a great guest. Thanks to Ken Holland for stopping by the podcast today, and thanks to the Edmonton Oilers for making him available. We turn our attention now to one of our own, Elliot Friedman. I'll tell you what, Craig Simpson and Jim Houston, we mentioned Jim going back to that 84 game on Global Sports, Sioux Greyhounds and Oshawa Generals. Jim Houston and Craig Simpson have been mainstays on Hockey Night in Canada for a number of years. They are the Cadillac of broadcast crews. But when I think of Craig Simpson, I think of someone that took so much physical punishment in the NHL just to stay in the game. And I think of someone who probably spent far too long in physical pain than he should have, considering how skilled a hockey player he was. Our colleague, Craig Simpson. When I say that name, what comes to Elliot Friedman's mind?
We did a piece on preparing for the playoffs years ago, and we talked to the equipment guys in Edmonton, who obviously were very well known, Barry Stafford being one of them. And he talked about all of the extra padding that he had to put underneath of Craig Simpson's jersey because they knew the abuse that he was going to take in front of the net. And that was one of the things he really talked about, was how much extra work he had to do with Simpson's stuff so he would be able to withstand the punishment. So when I think of Craig, I think of that conversation.
Craig Simpson has a lot of different titles and has had a lot of different titles in his time. Player, broadcaster, father, but he's added another title. Let's find out what that is. Here's Craig Simpson on 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Elliot, as we continue check-ins around the Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada camp, here's a good news story. Craig Simpson is now a grandfather. Simmer, welcome to the podcast and congratulations. How does that feel, other than perhaps maybe a little bit old?
Yeah, well, thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Elliot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a great ray of light and sunshine and for our family, everybody involved, Dylan and Haley. Welcome Stevie on April 1st of all days. You know, as Dylan said, to have a baby in the middle of a pandemic on an April Fool's Day, it's kind of quite a combination. But as you can imagine, it's, you know, we're all nervous of how long her due date, I believe, is today. And so to have her a few days earlier, I think sort of settles everybody down, allow things to happen before it gets worse. So we're all just absolutely thrilled.
Craig, I'm curious, how many people have said to Dylan or to Haley that Stevie in 13 years will be officially called a quarantine?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's no question about that. And, you know, the uniqueness of them, of the whole process hit them, what, in, like everybody, March 11th, March 12th, in that range where all of a sudden it was realized, okay, the Cleveland Monsters, who he plays for, Columbus's farm team, had a 9-day trip planned, you know, on the road trip. So there was a lot of nervousness there. He was going to be gone and, you know, on the road and not quite as accessible as even an NHL player, because most of the times they bus. So the fact that that all changed, I think sort of changed their perspective. You can imagine, guys, is, you know, when you're waiting for your first child, the thoughts of, for Haley, her mom, for Dylan, his mom being able to come in and maybe be a part of it. And, you know, the fact that they ended up just being in isolation on their own, you know, in some ways was difficult for them, but in others was, I just kept saying to them, this is beautiful. It's about you two and about you two sharing this moment together. And overall, you know, it went so well, and they're just thrilled now. And what's better, you know, than sitting in a in an apartment and looking at a 5 day old for all day? You know, they're so much fun. They change every day, and so it's a pretty exciting time for both of them.
You know, Simmer, you're 53 years old. You look terrific. I'm almost 50. I look like a bag of chips.
Yep.
Like, you know, like, what's it like? I'm curious. I have an 8 year old, so I'm not anywhere close to becoming a grandparent. But,
yep.
You know, I remember my father telling me how excited he was to be a grandfather, but it's weird hearing Grandfather Harvey in front of your name. Like, you're Grandfather yeah. Craig now. How does that feel?
I know. Well, you know, I feel very proud. And, you know, your firstborn was Dylan back in 1993. And to have him have the first child and be in a position where you hopefully sooner rather than later get to share in the joy of that is amazing. And as you know, Elliot, you know, we have a six-year-old as well. So Sammy is now an aunt, which I think is probably more strange for her than being a grandpa is for me. she kept saying, I'm not sure I want to be this aunt thing, Dad. I'm not sure I can handle that. But no, so having Samantha this last 6 years has kept me feeling young and feeling energized. And you don't take for granted. I think going through it again, you know, with another opportunity to have a little one around has given you the sense of, you know, how much different it is this time. I'm not in my late 20s, early 30s. And, you know, I was in my late 40s, early 50s and dealing with it the second time around. I think I have a greater appreciation for it. And I can't wait for the opportunity to have a grandchild. I mean, I even said to Dylan and Haley, Jamie and I were looking at the pictures 3 days later and go, oh my gosh, like she's changed so much. So we have no idea when we're going to get a chance to actually see her, but it'll be amazing how much she would have changed. And I just couldn't be happier. It's, you know, this has all been such a change. And I looked at the timing, Jeff and Elliot, and I thought we have our last game April 4th in Toronto mm-hmm. and then have a few days before. You know, in pre-planning, I thought I'm going to leave that Sunday open to see if maybe even fly into Cleveland. And if she is or has arrived, get there. Well, it would have worked perfectly. But as we know, that's all out the window.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Simmer, let me ask you the Canadian question then. Left shot or right shot? What is she?
She's got to be a righty, I hope. But, you know, Dylan's a lefty. He's a lefty both in hockey and golf. And so, you know, he's a unique one in that regard. So maybe those genes will wear off. Riley, our other son's a righty. Kennedy, our daughter's a righty. Samantha's a righty as well. So I think the righties have a chance maybe to win out.
You know what, Merrick? I thought you were going to ask, when she's able to play for the Olympic team, is she going to play for Canada or the U.S.?
Oh, that's true. Yeah, she's got an American...
Good
American
one.
American mom, Canadian dad, and born in the USA. So that will be an interesting, intriguing time. So we got lots of time to think, and we'll have to see where it leads to for sure.
Well, Simmer, just what's keeping you busy?
Yeah.
Well, as we sit and talk now, we have our scheduled. I'm officially now a grade one teacher, and Sammy and I will start our grade one class, and we usually go for about an hour and then have a little lunch break and then an hour or another half hour to 45 minutes and then go outside for quote unquote recess. And we've just tried as best we can to, you know, make some routine. We found early on, you know, this all happened for us. I'm not sure what your schooling was in Ontario, but our spring break was the 23rd week. And so we had the week before when we didn't go, everything was closed off, and then we had spring break. So we've kind of taken a little departure from getting in back into the school and just found that, you know, the kids love some free time, but they also are really struggling a bit without having that routine. And you take for granted, you know, Jesse's in grade 7, he's 12 and a half years old, and, you know, just missing the fact of going to school every day and interacting and working and having some real regiment to your day. I think everybody from whom I've talked to and the other families, you know, you maybe took that for granted, just how important that was for the kids' routine and their mental health. So we've tried in the last 7 to 10 days to get on more of a schedule and just get them into the mindset of, you know, even at times with Samantha right now, she's going, "Dad, can I sit on your lap?" And I go, "Hun, we're in school right now. You know, we got another 14 hours where you can be cuddling and sitting on me and watching something." But again, just trying to get them back to some normalcy. So it's been challenging. I must say, I have an incredible amount of respect. Our daughter, Kennedy, is a teacher, and she got a placement literally in the last 2 weeks before the everything was canceled. But they've kept her on, and she's doing online teaching. And, you know, I'm really impressed with how the schools have tried to handle it and tried to bring some normalcy and try to help families. You know, we're very fortunate that we have, you know, lots of space. We have lots of technology to do things with the kids. The thing I'm concerned of is how many families who don't have that and are struggling to keep the kids busy in a small enclosed area without the kind of, you know, means of having communication. I think that to me is probably the biggest fear, and we don't take that for granted at all here, the situation we're in.
You know, I think, Craig, that's so well said, because we're lucky too. Like, our school has given Max 3 online classes a day, which makes a huge difference. And it's the same rules for us. Like, you have to prepare from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Like, you're in school the whole day. And
well, you're a taskmaster then. We're not giving her that long.
Well, no, but he gets breaks. He gets breaks. Okay, but right, that right. Like, no video games, no iPad during that time. And now the weather's gotten a bit better, so we can go outside and we can play catch, and we played some cornhole this morning. But generally, that's, I don't know about you, Jeff, but I'm like Craig. Like, from 9 to 3, we try to act like we're in school as much as possible, and thank goodness they provided some online courses for it.
Yeah.
You know, I live in Edmonton, and gosh, the last 2 days we've had snowfalls. I'm looking out my front. I've got about 3.5 feet of snow on our front yard that's still got to go, and huge mounds. So that's been a challenge as well. I think the weather, you know, my younger son, Riley, who's finishing up at ASU online in Arizona State, you know, I'm looking at him and he's FaceTiming me, and it's like 30 degrees and sitting outside. Well, at least you can go in the backyard and enjoy the weather. That's been a challenge here out west, because the weather has been, you know, not really turning. And I think what that does, at least now our property and our backyard becomes open. I don't know if you saw earlier, we posted Jesse and Sammy had a little ski hill going down the backside. So they'd made the best of our environment. And I think that's what's important. But, you know, the thing, guys, that really concerns me the most, and, you know, not to be too somber and serious note, but Jamie and I have talked so much of, you know, not underestimating how difficult it is. There are so many families that, you know, my worry is domestic violence and kids who have been in tough situations now who are stuck, and families who are stressed, and, you know, mother and father who are struggling to make ends meet. And, you know, if we can do anything around our society is to try to protect those. And this is going to be, for me, guys, the biggest challenge going forward is to protect some of those who can't be protected themselves. And I talked with a business friend here in Edmonton who's talking with the Edmonton Chief of Police. And, you know, sadly, one of their biggest things, the biggest thing they're dealing with now is domestic incidents. And that's one of the things that is just flooding into their network. And so, you know, that concerns me a lot. I think we have to be aware of that and have our eyes open. If, you know, the difficult time now is we're so used to being able to interact and maybe help or go somewhere. And I don't know how you guys are feeling, but that to me is the most difficult thing, is to not just say, oh, okay, there's somewhere we can go and go help out or pitch in. I guess we're going to have to find ways to do it in other methods.
I agree.
That, you know what, Craig, that is such a wonderful message. And I can, that was, it's interesting. That's the first thing that my wife said to me on day one of quarantine. We put the kids to bed and she was sort of sitting there sort of having a tea and sort of staring off into space outside the window. And I'm like, what's the matter? And she said, I just can't imagine being someone who's in an abusive relationship right now. And physically cannot walk out the door. They can't leave. They are forced.
And I know that there have been efforts, and I've read about a bunch, Jeff, and you know, for anyone, that's been on the forefront of a lot of our communities, and say, you know, they're making efforts to bring places where you can go. So I don't have anything specific in front of me to point to, but my heart goes out to those kind of situations. And I think that's something that, you know, all the different good things that will come out of this environment, there are equally negative, and that's one I think we can't let go, and we have to make sure that, you know, somebody's there to help. And for people who feel in a helpless relationship where they feel they can't get out, we got to find a way to make sure that there's a place for them to go, because that scares me the most. As this turns from 3 weeks to a month or 2 months, who knows what it's going to be. That'll be something that we have to be on top of for sure.
Well, it's a fantastic thing you do in coordination with the Edmonton Police, because the more people that make everybody aware of it or say this is a concern, the more chance there is of something positive getting done.
Absolutely.
It's a hard pivot after that. However, Craig, I'm skeptical at best that there will be any hockey in the upcoming months. I've been wrong plenty in my life. I've never wanted to be wrong, but this time I really do want to be wrong. Where are you on this side of the conversation?
I'm with you, Jeff. I've been pretty realistic, as my wife will tell you. I'm a pretty serious realist. I research, I read a lot, and look at patterns and things that have gone other places. And right from the beginning of this, it's been a huge concern that, you know, I think it's naive for us to think that it'll be any different. I think here in Canada, we've done a fairly good job. But as you know, in our league and in our business, we're tied to the United States too, which I think is going to just be on the beginning of some serious problems. So I'd like to be positive, Jeff, and think that, you know, even a 2 month span might be enough. But I'm actually more concerned about next year. And I know from the league's perspective, you know, all the leagues ultimately love to see a completion of having the Stanley Cup, having the NBA championship. But I'm at this point, quite frankly, really nervous about even getting next year on the go. I just think if you look at the timelines from around the world and how this has gone on, I don't see it an opportunity for us to be in a position where you can hold these events. And even if you have them without fans in the stands, which, as you know, Elliot, that doesn't necessarily create a business model that works for anyone either. But even if you're able to do that, and from a television perspective, I think our ratings would be the best that they've been at any point. But I just don't see how you coordinate that and keep the health and wellness of all the people involved with it to a level that's safe enough. So, Jeff, I'd love to say, you know, maybe we'll get a playoff or a tournament going in August and finish this thing off and then get started in October. But, man, I hope we're right in that regard. But I'm really scared that we might get to September, October and still not have a sense of when we could get started.
I just have decided to look at it this way. I don't think we're going to have any idea about where we're going till at least June.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying the best I can to keep sane until the beginning of June, to try to enjoy life at home as much as I possibly can.
Yeah.
And I'll see where we are then, because the uncertainty is the toughest, but we just don't know.
You know, forget about the life and death that is at the forefront. I mean, that's where every time you have a thought or a discussion on sports, you go, well, what does that even matter? You know, so putting this first and foremost, it's the health of people that matter the most. But if you are looking ahead, I think it is important from a mental standpoint to not go into every day going, okay, well, is this going to be over next week or not? I think you're right, Elliot. You have to have a long-term scope and just say, this is the way it's going to be. Well, in, you know, take July 1st as a reset button and see where we are. And if you can do that, then like we just talked about with the kids in school or your activities or your energy or your workouts, whatever, you just say, this is the norm, that we have to create a pattern that allows you to be feeling mentally sharp and not depressed and not upset. And I think that's a hard challenge for everyone, and everybody will handle it differently. And, you know, I think of even my mother, who's in Chelsea Park in London, who now they're going to quarantine them for another 14 days. And, you know, she's 84 years old and she's on her own. And for the most part, her life hadn't changed all that much because she didn't do all that much from a going out perspective, but not being able to go to church on Sunday, not being able to go down now to have dinner and lunch. And, you know, you worry about someone alone like that. And even my sister, Chris, who lives on her own, you know, all of a sudden 3 months of just sitting in your house by yourself, talking to yourself, you know, those are great concerns. So I think that's the right mentality, Elliot, to just have it in your mind that we got to look forward to the July area and sort of reevaluate where we're going to be then.
Craig, we all know you're a great analyst. And I think anyone listening right now knows you're also an outstanding human being as well. Thanks so much for stopping by today. And congratulations, Grandpa Simmer.
Grandpa Simmer.
Craig, yes.
we're so thrilled, and thanks for having me. And please have me back on. I've been looking for more things to be involved in, and it helps get the mind going and pass the day. So appreciate you guys having me.
Perfect. Same time next week. You got it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Simmer.
You bet. Bye-bye.
He was a fantastic player. He's a fantastic broadcaster. No doubt he'll make an outstanding grandfather, Elliot, and he is a fantastic human as well. That's Craig Simpson, and great for Craig for raising awareness, as we mentioned, for people that are in distress and may feel trapped as we're all in quarantine right now. We step away. More on 31 Thoughts, the podcast. When we return, you will hear from the hockey mayor of Vegas, the man himself, Gary Lawless. Stay tuned. Elliot, it's very rare that we get a mayor to join us, but today we have the mayor of Vegas, who part-times as a digital columnist and a key part of the Lawless and Order group and does color on radio. That is, of course, our man, Gary Lawless. How are you today, Gary?
You know, I think I'm more famous for being a ardent and faithful listener to the 31 Thoughts podcast.
Well, actually, you know, I'll tell you what I always appreciate too is when you send me texts of you listening to the podcast, not so much of you physically listening, but pictures of you walking your dog while the podcast is going. So thanks for that, Gary.
If you guys ever came to my house and talked, because I don't wear earbuds when I'm walking them, there I just have the phone in my pocket.
Oh my.
They would immediately hear your voice. It's sort of like, you know, when you're supposed to speak to your baby before it's born, they would hear your voice and be like, oh, it's Uncle Jeff and Uncle Elliot. They'd know who you guys were right away.
It's pretty prominent status right there for each. How about that?
This is going to be kind of interesting when you go walking your dog tomorrow and you listen to yourself on the podcast while you're walking.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll do that.
That's like Inception.
I think tomorrow I'll listen to Hockey Central at noon instead of I'll listen to that podcast. Listen to Berkey instead of listening to myself.
Why would you listen to that garbage?
We could rename that. We could rename that segment for the walk tomorrow. Gary Lawless stars in "Oh Look, There's My Navel." You listening to yourself while walking your dogs as you play back our audio to that's. Right, you're right. That is Inception. That's swallowing your own face in a lot of ways.
I was a newspaper writer for a long time before I got into doing any broadcast. And the late Randy Turner, who was one of my best friends, and we were regular press box denizens.
Yeah.
Whenever he would catch me reading my own story, like not necessarily the hard copy, but like, you know, going online to read your column from the day before, he would, he had a phrase for it, which I will not use on this show, but I think you can kind of figure it. Fairly self-indulgent.
Well, okay, you know, let's begin there sort of, Gary, because sure. I mean, you go from Winnipeg to Vegas. that's an abrupt change. Like, that's sea change right there. How was that transition, and why'd you want to go?
I was in Winnipeg 18 years, 14 of them with the Winnipeg Free Press, and then the last four mostly with the Evil Empire, TSN. And, you know, had a pretty good gig going, doing some CFL work, doing lots of NHL work. I worked for a guy at TSN, two guys, Steve Dryden and Brett Bailey, that I really respected and admired and liked working for, and was under kind of Ken Volden's umbrella. And I love Kenny. So I kind of, you know, I had some aspirations and I had some dreams that that I thought I was going to be able to achieve there. And then Kelly McCrimmon got hired by the Vegas Golden Knights. And I actually, when George McPhee was the general manager of the Washington Capitals, I had no relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
When that changed, George and I struck up. I met him at the Combine in Buffalo. And it was weird. Elliot, you'll remember this. Garth Snow didn't send anyone to the Combine. The Islanders didn't, in the Garth Snow regime, they didn't believe in it. George would go on his own because he, when he was a consultant with the Islanders, he thought it was important to go and to talk to the guy. So I ended up getting to know George really well during that time. And he wasn't a GM in the league. And when I was writing columns about, you know, various things, I would send them to George and say, you know, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? My take on off the offside rule or on headshots or whatever it was. And we got to a pretty comfortable place. And Kelly McCrimmon, you know, was called me the mayor of Las Vegas. Kelly, you know, certainly could have been referred to as the mayor of Brandon, Manitoba.
Yep.
Has the owner, GM, and head coach of the Brandon Wheat Kings for a long time. Kelly and I have had a really excellent professional relationship that that had become a friendship too. So with both of those guys in Vegas, when they must have been kicking something around in the office one day, and then George phoned me and said, you know, what do you think of this? And the next day Kelly phoned and said, just so you know, we're serious here. That began a lot of conversations between my wife and I, and eventually led to coming to Vegas to meet Kerry Buchholz and Eric Tosi, and then deciding that we were going to jump into this. And I remember when I was leaving TSN, Mark Millier said to Volden, why would we get in his way? It's a 4-year contract. Let him go.
Mm-hmm.
When that's up, he'll be even more valuable to us then, because he'll have been truly inside. And if we decide that we want to bring him back, then we'll be getting a better version of Gary Lawless. And I had a conversation with Dryden about, you know, similar things, because he was like, why do you want to do this? And I said to him, I said, I kind of think that I have my BA in hockey. This is a chance to get my master's. And if I get really lucky, maybe to get my PhD. And I have learned more in my, you know, 2.5 seasons here. I got here before the expansion draft, and George and Kelly invited me into the room. I got to go in and watch what they were doing and how they were doing it and why they were doing it. And it was fascinating. There's been an open door policy for me with George and Kelly since I got here. And I have learned a ton from these guys. It's been professionally, it's been an unreal experience.
So what's the biggest thing you've learned, Gary, that you wouldn't have believed would have been the case?
And a very interesting question. I am fascinated, and this doesn't just come from George and Kelly. The smartest guys and the best managers are guys that are not afraid to share. And George and Kelly were there, and they still are. Like they have different titles, but they're co-GMs. They do this together, and they involve their staff. All of their staff, like everybody has a voice. And it's the confidence that George McPhee and Kelly McCrimmon have in themselves that allows them to give everybody an opportunity. I had a boss in Thunder Bay, an English guy, a Brit, who said in a meeting, I don't care whose idea it is, I want the best idea. And he actually meant it. And that is the way these guys operate here. You know, so I've learned lots of technicalities about how things get done and how they look at things. You know, you've heard that expression, great game, shitty business.
Yeah.
I saw that firsthand this year when Gerard Gallant got fired, because these guys, they agonized over, I didn't know it was coming, but after it happened, like the 24 to 72 hours after it, like their dogs had died. They loved Turk. They loved working with him. They loved being around him. And they made a really hard decision that they thought was going to be best for the team. So I guess the answer to the question is I've learned a lot about the personalities involved. I've learned a lot about leadership, and I've learned that from, I've watched Bill Foley's former leadership. I've watched Kerry Buchholz, who in the wake of October 1 stepped forward in an incredible way. And then I've learned about leadership from George and Kelly as well, and from Gerard, and now from Pete DeBoer. Because DeBoer is another one of those guys that, you know, make no mistake, Pete DeBoer is in charge. But all of those coaches, from Steve Spott to the guys that were here before, Ryan Craig, Ryan McGill, Tommy Cruz, and Mike Rizzatti, they all have a voice. They're all involved. The confidence and the surety of intelligence that it takes to lead on this stage, I've seen it firsthand, and that's been really cool.
I want to get to the coaches with you here, Gary, in a second, but I want to rewind because you mentioned the expansion draft and being able to have a perch there to watch it all go down. There were a couple of, I like to call them Picasso moves, moves that you look at, you go, oh, that's just brilliant. Like the Florida move was an expansion draft Picasso for Vegas. Minnesota was the same way. Were there a couple of times during that draft that you looked at and you said, wow, you're really painting a Picasso here?
Well, the Shea Theodore acquisition to me was like right off the bat, I was like, oh my God. And I have to admit to having some insider information there, because the coaches in Anaheim, Randy Carlisle with the big club and Dallas Aikens in San Diego, I knew both of those guys really well and had actually been in on a conversation at the draft in, oh boy, I can't think of which draft it was, but I'd heard those two guys talking about Shea Theodore, and it was a mixture. There was a mix of opinion on him, because Randy had one view of the player and Dallas had another view of the player. And Dallas's view was massive, incredible upside. And the first time you watch the guy skate, you're like, oh my God, this is so. Shane Knighty works with us, and well, Shane is really good at his job, but he also is very adroit at looking at defensemen and telling you immediately who they are and what they are. And like very early on in training camp with Shea, Dallas was like, watch, he does everything with his head up. Everything with his head up. He goes, no one else in the ice does it like that. And that makes him different. And you know, Niedermeyer was like that, did everything with his head up. So there's lots of guys that can skate and bring the puck up and, you know, transport it. How many guys can create offense at the end of that trip? And the only way to create offense is to be able to look and see where everybody is around you, to know if you should shoot, to know if you should shoot for a rebound, or to know if you should drop it to Carlson, who's joined you, or whoever it is. And Theodore can do that. He's not in the Norris conversation this year. He's going to be. So to me, like that level of player, to be able to get that, and I really knew right from the beginning that this guy was going to be special, that to me was one of the heists of the expansion draft. Why'd you go, like you don't agree? Like,
I like Shea Theodore. I thought that the default was always, wow, what they were able to do with the Florida Panthers.
Gary, he says that whenever he thinks the thing that someone just said is absolutely terrible and stupid.
Well, I'm going to hear that a few times today.
Here's the interesting thing about Shea Theodore, as you can well recall at that point. There was a group that said, this guy's never going to stick full-time in the NHL. This guy was a high pick, and I know that Anaheim was loaded with young defensemen, and they've traded most of them for whatever reason. But there was a large group that thought, you know what? if he makes it, he's just going to be a good defenseman. But there was a large camp that never thought that this defenseman that we see in Vegas right now was ever going to materialize in the NHL.
Well, give Ryan McGill a lot of credit for that, because when Shea made mistakes, and I guess, and put Derek Englund in there too, because Derek played a lot with Shea early on. When Shea made mistakes and he would come back to the bench with his head down, Ryan didn't beat him again. He picked him up. And Ryan McGill is, and if you've spent any time around him, he's not warm and fuzzy, right?
Yep.
But he kept this guy's spirits lifted and rebuilt his confidence. And McGill talks, it's so fun being around these guys because you learn so much. McGill talks about with pilots, and what I think it's the 10,000 hour rule.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell, yeah.
After 10,000 hours, a pilot has seen everything, right? McGill has a number of games for a defenseman that has that same rule where after that many games, you've seen everything and you've been through everything, so you know how to handle it. And that, I think, has been a big factor for Shea Theodore.
You mentioned Derek Englund a second ago, and you know, you can make a list of whether it's, you know, Ryan Miller, or maybe throw Jimmy Howard into that mix, and Jonathan Erickson. You wonder about if there's no more hockey for the remainder of this season, players that have played their last game without knowing that it was their last game. Do you think Derek Englund is in that camp?
I don't want to play GM because that's not my job, but you know, obviously he hasn't been in the lineup as regular this year as he has been. And you've got White Cloud has made the team. Nick Hag has played a bunch of games and then been down in the American League. They've got Jimmy Schultz. They've got Dylan Coughlin. They've got Jake Bischoff. There's a list of guys that, you know, you work with Berkey, Brian Burke.
Yeah.
And when I was in Manitoba, they had a bunch of guys. The team in Vancouver was so good that there were a bunch of guys, Brandon Reed, Ryan Reddy, Pat Cavanaugh, all these guys that were kind of, that were good enough to play in the NHL, but never got a sniff. And eventually the carrot was taken away from them and they had to go to other organizations for Europe or whatever they had to do. And you got to be careful about that. And George McPhee talks a lot about, you know, having at least one or two guys come up from the American League every year and joining your roster, not just to be cheap players, but to be cheap and good players. And Vegas's depth in the prospect pool right now is at the defense position. So that, you know, that does paint a difficult picture for a veteran.
All right. So I wanted to ask you, Gary, you know, you moved down to Vegas. We all have this impression of Vegas. You know, we come there and we love going there. We're on the strip, we're gambling, we're having nice dinners. You know, you live near the practice facility in Henderson. What's it like to live in Vegas?
It's in Summerlin. I think you have Henderson.
Oh, Summerlin. So
Henderson is where the organization is building a new arena, which is going to host our American Hockey League team.
Just so you know, Gary, I'm not known for my accuracy as a reporter.
Yes, no problem.
So,
good. All right. Excellent. I'll tell you a funny story. So I'm from Peterborough, Ontario. And I had always heard of this guy, Randy Morton, and I had never met him. He's a little bit older than me. And Randy is the president and chief operating officer of the Bellagio. It's February in Winnipeg, and I have my, again, I'm with my dogs. I have a, there's a dog park in Charleswood that I would go to in Winnipeg. And I'm there and I phone the Bellagio because I'm trying to figure out, you know, do I really want to move my wife and daughter to Las Vegas? So I phone the Bellagio because I don't have Randy Morton's number because I've never met him. And I get the front desk and I say, Randy Morton, please. Eventually I get kicked up to his assistant and she says, okay, how can I help you? I said, I'd like to speak to Randy Morton. She said, what's it about? And I said, well, it's personal. And she said, no offense, but you know, this man is the president of a casino. He gets, you know, we gotta have a little more than it's personal. I'm like, okay, well, tell him I'm from Peterborough. And she said, oh, I can give you the Peterborough rate. Apparently there's a, apparently if you want to stay at the Bellagio, there's a rate that you can get if you're from
Peterborough. Oh, that's big.
I don't know if there's any truth to that or not.
Secret's out.
I'm like, no, no, I don't need a room. And then finally I'm like, you know what? Tell him I'm the guy from Peterborough that works for TSN. And if he knows who I am, here's my number and give me a call. Well, 5 minutes later, the phone rings. And I had forgotten, and I knew this, that Randy Morton had married Susan Chason, who is Steve Chason's widow.
Ah.
And Susan, like, I know her, I know her sister, I know her younger brother. So somehow that all came together later. But Randy got on the phone with me and he said, well, we've raised four kids here. Because when he married Susan, you know, Steve Chason and Susan had three kids. Michael Chason, who's now the head coach of the San Jose Barracuda in the American Hockey League. And then they had another child that they had together. So they'd raised four kids in Vegas. And he's like, he said, you know, Susan, this is not, the strip is the strip. There's another whole world here. There's soccer, there's schools, it's not all, you know, the Spearmint Rhino and blackjack. There's other stuff that goes on in this town. So when my wife and I went out the first time, you know, we got a look around and we saw communities and we saw schools. And then we went out on my daughter's March break. We brought her and we actually, her first night in Vegas, she stayed at a suite at the Bellagio overlooking the fountains. And there was a big Bellagio teddy bear on the bed for her when she arrived. But it's a wonderful place to live. Like, my daughter goes to a great school. We have met, it's so funny, my first day at my daughter's school, a gentleman walked up to me and said, hi, Gary, my name's David Delzato. I'm from Toronto. His family is the Delzato family of Tridel, the condominium.
Yeah, we've heard of them.
So David has become like a best friend. And then a woman walked up to me and she literally had on a Saskatchewan Rough Riders t-shirt. And she said, I'm from Sasky, so I probably shouldn't like you, but I'm going to try because your daughter's so sweet. You're coming to our house for Canadian Thanksgiving. And her name, she's married to a guy named Bill Coulthard. Her name's Carla Coulthard, but her family is from Meadow Lake, Saskatchewan. And again, like, we had Canadian Thanksgiving at our house this year, and it was loaded with people. One of the guys is a guy named Brian Benowitz, who spent time in Winnipeg growing up, and he runs the Cosmopolitan out here. So it's really weird. Like, you meet these really nice people that, you know, you would, in other places they would be, you know, doctors, or they'd, you know, run the widget factory or whatever. Well, here, the industry in Vegas is gaming.
Yep.
And you just meet a ton of people from that line of work. And in our experience, it's been great. And we've really enjoyed it. And we're lucky that we got to keep a small little place in Canada to go to in the summer on the shores of Lake Winnipeg. So it's been super cool. So much about it has been fantastic.
Awesome.
Give us a snapshot of what's happening in Vegas right now.
Yeah, it's quiet. Governor Sisolak, he boldly and with a visionary approach to COVID-19 shut the strip down. Shut down all non-essential businesses. It's very quiet here. And so far, entire state of Nevada, I don't know, I haven't seen the overnight numbers, but prior to this morning, the state of Nevada had not reached 2,000 cases yet. And think about this. This is a place where I think the number is 5 million visitors a year come to Vegas. So just think about, you know, people from all over the world coming here and what that could have meant to this city. Like, Vegas, by all rights, should be devastated right now with this disease, and they're not. And tip of the cap to the governor and then to Nevadans and all the people here that have kind of, you know, really stood together to try and knock this thing down. And the owners of the hotels, the gaming industry, stepped up to help their people. You know, I was here for October 1, you know, one of the worst days in the history of the United States for a community, 58 murdered and over 500 wounded. And I got to watch this community kind of pick itself up after that. And like, that's a chapter of the book to the, you know, we talk about hockey players all the time. At the Las Vegas Convention Center, they had a room where they were inviting family of people that were at that concert. That's where you went to this room. And you would say, my name is Bill Smith. And my daughter, Jill Smith, was at the concert. And they would find out where Jill Smith was. And sometimes it was in a hospital bed, sometimes it was in a hotel room, or sometimes it was in a morgue. And we were there for a tour of the facility to see what they were doing to help people. And our players were, you know, in shorts and jerseys. And they're standing in this area as these people are start to come out of these rooms. And this wasn't arranged, wasn't set up. It just happened that, you know, a woman came out and was like breaking down. And one of our players grabbed her and put his arms around her. And then our guys started doing that to all these people that were coming out. And it was, you know, it's something that I'll never, ever forget. It was just a great act of humanity. But you saw that all over Vegas during that time. And you're seeing that again right now.
Well, Gary, one thing we've learned is that Vegas is an outstanding entrance into the NHL, not only because of the way they've achieved on the ice, but what they've done in the community off the ice. And thanks a lot for your time, man. You know what? I have to tell you, I'm always jealous of your good weather. Only now is it getting better where we live in Toronto. And that's one of the best advantages, I think, of being in Vegas that you've had through this, is you can at least go outside a little easier, take a walk, get some fresh air, walk the dog. And man, more power to you. I'm glad it worked out great for you in your career.
Yeah, well, you know what? You guys are in Toronto, and my mom, dad, brother, and sister are all up the road in Peterborough. And I'm hoping that I'm hoping globally that we all get through this, but you guys are in a place real close to my heart. So I hope everybody is safe, and I hope everybody's healthy, and we can get through this as best as possible.
You're the goods, Gary. Hey, pass along a big hello to our former colleague, Darren Millard. We miss him around here, okay?
Yes. Well, that Mallard has become my cross to bear. that's how I'm going to end this.
From Peterborough to Winnipeg to Vegas, the man, Gary Lawless. He's one of my favorite people in this industry. The times that I'm on the road and Gary's there, I've gone out with him a couple of different times, always a lot of fun, always has great stories and has stories about everybody. And he's one of those people that seems to just know everybody. You know those kind of people, Elliot, like, oh yeah, I know Gary Lawless. I mean, how many times have you heard, oh yeah, I know Gary Lawless? That's Gary.
He's got a great gig too.
I wonder if Seattle creates the Gary Lawless gig. I would imagine they would. It would just make sense for any franchise, you know, heretofore would create what I've now deemed the Gary Lawless gig. It's a good one and it's a smart one.
You've got to have, I think, if you're a team, the one male or female who kind of becomes the face of your team. Who is that? That's not a player, obviously, or an executive.
Mm-hmm.
Gary's kind of done that.
I think the word ambassador is too strong and has a lot of connotations that wouldn't apply to Gary and what he does. But he's someone that is there to talk to that market about that team, but also considering it is a relatively, you know, virginal hockey market, someone that has a strong hockey background himself that can provide proper context for new hockey fans. And that's why I ask about that position for a team like the Seattle 32s.
I like that you call them the 32s. You know they're going to be the Kraken, right?
Not if I have anything to say about it, Elliot, which I don't, so they're going to be called the Kraken.
Well, the thing is, right, like, we don't know what's going to go on here, but for the next year, in theory, you're going to need someone to kind of... I would be looking at hiring somebody like that now. Yes, I think it's a great idea to introduce your market to the team. These are your people. This is your market. This is who you're going to deal with. This is what's to come. I think it's a great idea. I really do.
Yeah, so do I. And thanks to Gary for stopping by today. Thanks to Craig Simpson from Hockey Night in Canada for stopping by. And thanks to Ken Holland, general manager of the Edmonton Oilers. Our next podcast, and we can't wait to get this one out, is our conversation with Brooks Like, former NHLer. Certainly we all remember him playing with the Washington Capitals, drafted by the Ottawa Senators, strong junior hockey career as well. He's done something really neat with his life right now, and you can find out all about it on Instagram or online at Open Gym. Training, physical training. We talked about mental training a couple of weeks ago here on the podcast, and we talked about that. But from a physical point of view, keeping yourself healthy physically, Elliot, as we're all living the quarantine life right now, I had a lot of fun talking to Brooks Like yesterday.
He was a great guest. He was a really good guest. And you know, one of the things now that I really like about, maybe the only thing now I like about our world, is that there are some people out there who really want to bend over backwards to help others mentally, physically. And you know what? There's no cost to them. They're not making any money for it. They're just doing it to help people out. And I think it's a great thing. And I'm glad to help promote things like that. Like I love what McDavid's doing. You know, I like what Like is doing. There's other apps and fitness websites out there that are making themselves free. I think it's a great thing, and I'm happy to promote all that.
I'm with you. And you'll hear that conversation shortly on 31 Thoughts, the podcast, our conversation with Brooks Like, where we do talk a lot about taking care of yourself physically, but there are some really cool hockey stories in there as well, including, man, I loved this story when you asked him about Maple Leafs training camp and competing with Bert Olmsted for a job on the Maple Leafs. And the answer he gave about his grandmother watching him skate is fantastic.
Yes, it is.
Look forward to that one when the Brooks Like podcast comes out here on 31 Thoughts. Again, thanks to all of our guests, Gary Lawless, Craig Simpson, and Ken Holland, GM of the Edmonton Oilers. On behalf of Amal Dulich, our producer, and Elliot Friedman, Jeff Merrick saying, be safe, wash your hands, stay inside, be well, be safe. We'll talk to you soon.